way to Perth Amboy, then back to Elizabeth. Steve tried to hide his disappointment. He'd had a different idea about how the afternoon would go, and it didn't include Kathy's mother. Laura Barnes didn't like this weather. She looked out the window of her first-floor apartment on South Street, holding the baby in her arms. Today's flight was nothing, she reminded herself, just a Convair 240 on a milk run, something Tim had done hundreds of times. He could do it in his sleep, not that he would, but still. On the kitchen radio, Patty Page was singing Tennessee Waltz. Laura began to dance around with the baby in her arms. Heather squealed with delight. Laura paused again at the living room window. This fog is crazy, she thought. They never had fog in January, and all this rain. It must be the January thaw. Her three-year-old was still napping. If only she could get the baby to sleep, she'd be able to rest her back, which was killing her. She was pregnant with their third child, expecting in July. She and Tim were both secretly hoping for a boy after two girls, though neither would admit it. On Valentine's Day, they'd be moving into their new house down the shore, with enough room for three children, not to mention two full baths. She'd never had her own bath. Well, she'd be sharing with Tim, but still, a grown-up's only bathroom. Their apartment was already feeling cramped. Even though her parents owned this house and lived upstairs, which was a huge help, she was ready for the move. They'd worked on the new house all weekend while her parents watched the girls. She measured for curtains in the bedrooms and lined the kitchen shelves with wallpaper in a pretty pattern left over from her cousin's new kitchen, while Tim worked on building a cedar closet in the attic. Before driving back, they'd stopped for a short dinner to celebrate their anniversary. She promised that next time she'd at least taste the lobster. Tim laughed. He was more adventurous than her in every way, but he didn't seem to mind. Only a month ago, he'd returned from Korean airlift duty. Then it was a round trip to Tokyo. She was so proud of her husband. He'd seen the world. Someday, when the children were grown, she'd travel with him. She'd already prepared a meatloaf for supper. Tim loved her meatloaf. She just had to pop it in the oven. The potatoes were peeled, sitting in ice water, ready for boiling. She'd take out the frozen peas at the last minute. Bird's-eye vegetables were a godsend, never mind what her mother said. Of course, nothing beat her mother-in-law, Helen's, cooking. She'd be at work now in the Osner's fancy kitchen, watching over Dr. Osner's little girl while preparing dinner for the family. Maybe someday, when Helen retired and had more time, she'd help out Laura, moving down the shore and taking care of the three kids. Then Laura could go back to school, get her degree in education, and teach kindergarten or first grade. At the very least, Helen could show her how to fix those fancy meals she made for the Osners. The baby jumped up and down in her arms until she started dancing again. She sang along with Patty Page. I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee Waltz. Miri and Natalie rode the number 24 bus from school, got off at the corner of Shelley and Meiji, then walked down to the Osner's house. In the kitchen, Fern was dunking Oreos in milk while Mrs. Barnes prepared dinner. Whatever she was browning on the stove smelled delicious. The salad leaves were drying in a cloth towel, waiting to be torn into an ebony bowl with Corinne's initials in silver, CMO, for Corinne Mendelson Osner. Someday, when Miri was married with her own house, she would have the same salad bowl with her initials in silver, M-A-M, for Miri Ammerman McKittrick, if she married Mason. But would Irene ever forgive her for marrying a boy who wasn't Jewish? Maybe she would just spell out Miri and leave her husband out of it.
Will Tim fly over our house today?
Fern asked Mrs. Barnes. I expect so, Mrs. Barnes said. Any minute now, unless they were delayed by the weather. Fern pretended to feed an Oreo to her cowboy bunny.
Roy Rabbit might be a pilot when he grows up.
I hope he's smart, Mrs. Barnes said, because you have to be smart to be a pilot.
Don't worry, Fern said. Roy Rabbit is very smart.
Natalie grabbed a bunch of green grapes, and she and Miri headed for the den, where the windows looked down on a stand of Japanese cherry trees, bare now, but come spring, she knew they'd be heavy with pink blossoms. She wished it could be spring now. Then she and Mason wouldn't have to worry about where to go to be alone and warm. Natalie tuned the television to the Kate Smith show, though it wasn't quite 4 o'clock, while Miri made a quick phone call to remind Irene she was at Natalie's for the afternoon. Then both girls settled on the floor. Miri popped a grape into her mouth. Natalie rested her head on Miri's lap.
Play with my hair, she said.
Miri lifted one soft curl, then another.
What are you thinking?
Natalie asked, looking up at her.
Guess,
Miri said.
I'll bet it's about Mason.
Not really.
I'll bet you think about him every minute of every day.
I think of him a lot, but I wasn't thinking of him just now.
Are you in love with him?
I've only known him 38 days, not that I'm counting.
My mother says she knew from the minute she first looked into my father's eyes she was going to be with him for the rest of her life. She says it came to her in a flash, like lightning.
I haven't had that flash yet, Miri said, which was a complete lie. Didn't she know it the night they danced together in Natalie's finished basement? And if not then, at the Y, the first time they kissed? Who was she kidding? But what went on between her and Mason was private. That's how she knew it was special. Every other time she'd liked a boy, she'd blab to all her friends about him. But not this time.
Are we still best friends?
Natalie asked out of nowhere, winding a piece of gray wool she'd found on the carpet around her finger.
I can't believe you have to ask, Miri said. It's just that lately you've been so...
Natalie stopped, searching for just the right word.
Remote,
she finally said, looking satisfied. Miri was stung.
You go to New York for dance classes 3 days a week, and you're calling me remote?
Natalie sat up.
I didn't think you even noticed I was gone. You're always with Mason, or you're babysitting with Suzanne.
Natalie smoothed down her curls.
Even at school, you hang out with Robo more than me.
I do not.
You sit with her every day at lunch, laughing.
You're at the same lunch table.
But nobody laughs with me.
Miri looked at Natalie and realized it was true. Christina. Mr. Durkee, who taught bookkeeping at Batten, asked Christina to assist with his late class. Christina was his star pupil. If she didn't mess up, she'd be graduating first among the girls in the business program. Today she'd be working late at Dr. O's office. Mrs. Jones and her daughters were coming in for checkups. Daisy scheduled their appointments after hours because Mrs. Osner was afraid if Dr. O's regular patients discovered Dr. O was treating colored people, they might be upset. They might even switch to a different dentist. Dr. O, on the other hand, believed Mrs. Jones and her daughters deserved the best dental care. He had Daisy set up a plan for them with a sizable discount because, after all, she worked for the Osners, and her girls were polite and doing well at school. As long as she left school by 3:45 p.m., she'd make it to Dr. O's office in time. While the students were at their desks taking a test, Christina grabbed her raincoat and umbrella. She was glad she was wearing old shoes in this crazy weather. She heard a plane overhead, but when she looked out the window, she couldn't see anything, the fog was so dense. Suddenly, the building rumbled. The girls looked up from their test papers, a few of them rushing to the windows. in time to see a twin-engine plane thunder out of the fog, heading straight for them. One girl screamed. Another crossed herself and started a Hail Mary. Christina was sure the plane was coming through the window into the classroom.
"Get back from the glass," Mr. Durkee shouted. "Duck and cover."
But there was almost no time. The engine of the plane went quiet as it barely sailed over the roof of the school. The first explosion caused the windows to rattle. The second, louder explosion shook the building.
"Oh, my God! Jack!" Christina cried. "Jack! Jack!"
She ran from the classroom with Mr. Durkee calling after her.
"Christina, stay inside! Christina!"
She flew down the two flights of stairs, then used the white marble steps from the first floor to the street, steps the students were not allowed to use. Outside, she rounded the corner of South and Williamson streets and raced toward the flames, toward Mrs. O'Malley's house, where Jack rented a room on the second floor. Mary. Kate Smith hadn't even sung God Bless America when the program was interrupted by an announcement. An announcement so horrible, it left her and Natalie immobile. A second plane had crashed in Elizabeth, this time near Batten High School. Before they had time to digest what they'd just heard, the sound of a long, low wail came from the kitchen. Without a word, the two girls were on their feet, racing down the stairs. They found Mrs. Barnes doubled over, holding on to the kitchen counter.
"No, please, God, no!"
Natalie pulled open the door to the finished basement, closed it behind her, and disappeared. Mary grabbed a plastic glass from the counter, filled it with water, and tried to give it to Mrs. Barnes. But Mrs. Barnes, who had always seemed so in control, so calm, no matter what, knocked it away. The deep voice on the radio continued,
"An American Airlines Convair en route to Newark Airport from Buffalo, with stops in Rochester and Syracuse, has crashed and exploded."
Now Mrs. Barnes screamed, fell to the floor, banging her fists, pulling at her own hair. Fern squatted beside her.
"Barnsy, stop! Please stop!"
Mary had never heard Fern or anyone else call her Barnsy. Mrs. Barnes didn't let up. She wailed,
"Tim! Timmy!"
"Barnsy!" Fern cried. "Barnsy, you're scaring me!"
Mary didn't know what to do, so she picked up the phone and dialed Dr. O's office. When Daisy answered, Mary cried it was Mrs. Barnes's son flying that plane, and Mrs. Barnes was on the floor and wouldn't get up. Daisy told her to stay with Mrs. Barnes, not to leave her for a second, and she and Dr. O were on their way. Mary knew from health class when someone was in shock, you should keep them warm, so she sent Fern upstairs to get a blanket, then, as an afterthought, a pillow, too. Fern came back with a pillow and quilt from Natalie's room, and Mary draped it over Mrs. Barnes, who had gone quiet and white as a ghost, lying on her back on the floor. Mary slid the pillow under Mrs. Barnes's head. Her eyes were open, staring at the ceiling. Mary wondered if she was in shock, or if it was something worse. Fern sat close to Mrs. Barnes, stroking her hand.
"Barnsy, I need you to take care of me. Roy Rabbit needs you."
She nuzzled Mrs. Barnes with her toy rabbit, but Mrs. Barnes didn't respond. Laura. Laura heard the explosions, but it was the general fire alarm that filled her with dread. She knew Tim was due in at about that time. The noise of the alarm woke the toddler, Evie, who started screaming. Laura ran to the girls' room, lifted Evie out of her crib, and patted her back.
"There, there, sweetie. Everything's okay."
That started the baby, Heather, crying. When word came over the radio that it was a plane, an American Airlines Convair, Laura knew for sure. She lay down on her bed with the toddler and the baby cradled on either side of her and began to sing,
"Hush, little babies, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird."
Steve. At first, he and Phil didn't get what the commotion at the American Airlines counter was about. It wasn't until Phil's aunt screamed, a chilling scream you could hear throughout the terminal, a scream that would haunt him the rest of his life, that they understood something had happened to the plane. Phil rushed to his aunt's side with Steve right behind him, but she had already collapsed, and two airline employees were trying to get her to her feet. Phil tossed the keys to the blue Ford convertible to Steve. "Drive it back to my house, okay?" "Sure," Steve said. "Whatever I can do to help, you know." But Steve didn't have any idea how to help. He called his father's office from a phone booth. His father would know what to do. His father would offer to come and get him, and Steve would say, "Okay." But there was no answer at his father's office. He wished he'd never come to the airport. He wished he'd stayed at school, then gone to the Y to shoot baskets. Nobody asked if he was okay enough to drive, which he wasn't, but somehow he made it back to Elizabeth, to Phil's house, where he pulled the blue convertible into the driveway, turned off the ignition, rested his head against the wheel, and gave in to the emotion washing over him. He couldn't remember the last time he'd cried, felt his own tears, hot and wet, running down his face, his throat tight, his nose snotty. He took in a couple of big gulps, willed himself to stop, then got out of the car and started out for home, kicking at stones, leftover chunks of gray snow, whatever was in his way. Fuck, fuck, fuck! Christina. Hundreds of people were running with Christina, all of them separated from the roaring fire by just a dozen yards. But only she was screaming Jack's name, until she turned the corner and saw it wasn't Jack's house on fire. It was the wooden house down the street, and the house next to that, and where there used to be a three-story brick apartment building, was rubble and thick black smoke, the whole area a blazing mess, with flames so blindingly bright red and orange, she had to turn away. She covered her ears with her hands against the screaming sirens. There was no sign of the plane, or the people on it. She was stuck in a nightmare where something terrible was happening, but she was powerless. She willed herself to move, but she couldn't. Her feet were too heavy, as if they were encased in wet cement, and she couldn't lift them. When she looked down, she saw her feet were covered in mud up to her ankles, mud from the rain and the fire hoses. "Jack is safe," she told herself, "working for the electric company in Westfield or Cranford or some other nearby city. Jack is safe. Unless because of the weather. He's not. No, he is. He has to be." Christina, who never showed her emotions in public, didn't try to restrain herself this time. She cried out as she saw a woman, her own clothes on fire, frantically pushing a small child rolled up in a rug at a neighbor. The woman tried to rush back into the flaming house, screaming, "My baby! My baby!" But others held her away. People were running from the burning houses. A boy with his jacket on fire was grabbed by a man who threw off his overcoat and wrapped the boy in it, putting out the flames. The girls from the modern dance club in their blue leotards were on the scene, with the gym teacher. Groups of other students who had club meetings after school were hugging each other and crying. A few of them called to her, but she didn't answer. She caught a glimpse of Jack's landlady, and in an instant she was chasing after her. "Mrs. O'Malley! Mrs. O'Malley!" Christina called, until Mrs. O'Malley stopped. "Mrs. O'Malley, I'm Jack McKittrick's friend, Christina. Was he home? Is he okay?" Mrs. O'Malley gave her a puzzled look. "Jack?" "Yes, Jack McKittrick. He rents from you."
"Are you his sister?"
"No, I'm his friend, Christina."
"I always thought you were his sister."
What was she talking about?
"He's not home," Mrs. O'Malley said. "I don't know where he is."
"At work," Christina said. "He's at work, right?"
"I hope so, dear."
The world may have been falling apart, but at Dr. O's office, everything was serene. Christina pulled down the hastily scribbled note
taped to the office door, apologizing for the emergency that had taken both Daisy and Dr. O away. She got out of her muddy shoes before unlocking the door with the key Daisy had given to her at Christmas. She was safe now. She prayed Jack was safe, too. She scrubbed her feet in the toilet, flushing again and again, wiped herself clean with disposable towels, and changed into her white lab coat and shoes. She had no clean socks, no stockings. She'd have to wear her shoes with bare feet. She pinned up her dark hair, washed her face, and gargled with Lavoris. Only then did she sit in Daisy's swivel chair, in front of the Remington typewriter and the leather appointment book, calmly calling patients, asking them to call tomorrow to reschedule. She felt grown up, helpful, even important, until her sister Athena phoned and gave her hell. "Why didn't you call us? We've been worried sick. Really, Christina, grow up. Take responsibility. Did you give a second's thought to Mama, who's going out of her mind with worry?"
"I'm sorry," Christina said. "I tried to call, but I couldn't get through."
This was a lie. She hadn't been thinking about her mother or Athena.
"You should have come here."
Athena was using her holier-than-thou voice. "How far is the shop from your job? I'd say 5 minutes, if that. And you should have stopped in at the restaurant to see Baba."
"You're right," Christina said.
She'd learned the best way to avoid an argument with her sister was to agree.
"I wasn't thinking."
"That's no excuse," Athena told her.
"In case you're interested," Christina said, "I saw it happen. The plane came right over Baton. I was outside on Williamson Street a minute after it crashed and exploded."
She was getting worked up, her voice rising with her emotions.
"I was there, Athena. I was there when people ran out of their houses screaming, on fire. Do you know what that was like? Do you even care?"
Before she could slam down the receiver, her sister said, "Well, that sounds terrible, but I don't see why you're angry at me." This time, Christina did slam down the receiver. The palm of her right hand was bleeding from digging her fingernails so deeply into it. She hated Athena. She ran into the small, narrow lab, where Daisy kept a row of white Plaster of Paris figurines lined up on a shelf, each one a foot high, waiting for Dr. O to smash if he felt a temper coming on. Christina had witnessed his fury just once, and it had scared her. How could this kind and generous man have such inner rage? What set him off? She only knew it never happened when there were patients in the office. She only knew that smashing one of the Plaster of Paris figurines made him feel better. After, Daisy would sweep up the remains, and Dr. O would carry on as if nothing had happened. Now, as the rage boiled up inside of her, Christina grabbed one of those figurines and smashed it. She thought she would feel better, but she didn't. She slumped to the floor, her eyes closed against the headache coming on. She sat there, surrounded by the remains of Dopey, or whichever one of the seven dwarves she had smashed, until the phone rang. She went back to Daisy's desk and picked it up, praying it wasn't Athena again, or worse, her mother. "Good afternoon, Dr. Osner's office," she said, trying to sound professional.
"Is this Daisy?"
"No, it's Christina."
"Oh, Christina. This is Mrs. Jones. Someone called earlier to cancel our appointment."
Mrs. Jones's voice went very low and soft, as if she were about to share a secret.
"I was wondering if you happened to know if the pilot was Mrs. Barnes's son."
Mrs. Barnes's son? Mrs. Barnes, who she'd met once when Daisy sent her to the Osner's house with a package? Mrs. Barnes's son was in that flaming wreck?
"Christina, are you there?"
"Yes, I'm still here."
Her voice sounded small and unsure of itself. She cleared her throat several times.
"I'm asking because I know Mrs. Barnes from working at the Osner's," Mrs. Jones said. "And if, well, I'd like to be there."
Christina was barely able to hold herself together. She rolled out a piece of scotch tape and stuck it to her arm, as if that would help.
I'll call if I hear anything.
She went back to the lab, picked up the broom, swept up the mess, and washed off the floor. She felt overwhelmingly tired, as if she hadn't slept for days. She felt if she didn't lie down immediately, she would keel over. She lay down on the sofa in the waiting room, where she smelled something terrible, something burned or burning. What was it? She sniffed her arms, a handful of her hair. It was coming from her. Her hair, her skin, the clothes she wore under the white lab coat, all of her smelled terrible. Maybe she would always smell that way, a reminder of what she'd seen. She could wash and wash, and still it would be there. Christina Demetrius, the girl who smelled like fire and smoke and death. She closed her eyes. An hour went by, maybe two. Then there was a knock on the office door. Daisy had instructed Christina to keep the door locked when she was alone in the office.
"Who is it?" she asked.
"Christina! Christina! Are you okay?" She opened the door and fell into Jack's arms. Miri was relieved when Dr. O and Daisy rushed into the house. Mrs. Barnes was still on the floor, covered by the quilt. She still hadn't said a word. Dr. O bent down to check her pulse. As he did, he glanced toward the basement door, and for the first time, Miri was aware of the music coming from downstairs.
"Is it true?"
Mrs. Barnes asked Dr. O. He answered, "Yes. I'm so sorry." Mrs. Barnes nodded. Dr. O helped Mrs. Barnes to her feet and led her to a chair at the kitchen table. Daisy brought her a glass of water and handed her a pill. But Mrs. Barnes's hands were shaking so badly, Daisy had to put the pill into Mrs. Barnes's mouth, then hold the water glass to her lips. Mrs. Barnes swallowed without asking what it was.
"Is there anyone I can call for you?" Daisy asked.
"My other son, Charles. He'll call my daughter," Mrs. Barnes said. "She lives in Pennsylvania." "She has another son," Miri thought. "A son and a daughter. That's good, isn't it? Suppose Tim was her only child." How many times had Rusty reminded Miri, "You're my only child. You're my life. So when it comes to doing stupid things, don't. Because I couldn't stand it if I lost you. Do you understand?" Now Miri thought she understood. There was a burden to being the only child.
"Daisy, will you try to find Corinne?"
Dr. O asked, handing her an appointment book with a needlepoint cover.
"I'm going to take Mrs. Barnes home."
He draped a coat around Mrs. Barnes's shoulders and led her to the kitchen door. Fern clung to Mrs. Barnes's leg.
"I want to come with you."
"You stay here with Daisy until Mommy comes home,"
Dr. O said.
"No, I want to come with Barnesy."
Mrs. Barnes looked down at Fern, as if for the first time.
"You'll be fine, Fern Ella."
Fern didn't argue. She let go of Mrs. Barnes's leg. When Daisy asked if she'd like to hear a story, Fern chose Madeline from her bookshelf.
"Madeline is brave,"
she told Daisy. Daisy asked Miri to do something about the volume of the music coming from the finished basement. Miri opened the door and crept down the stairs, afraid of what she might find.
Natalie?
She called softly. The only light was coming from the jukebox, the volume pumped way up. It took a minute for her eyes to adjust, for her to see Natalie crouched on the floor in the corner, rocking back and forth, mumbling to herself, like an old man davening on the high holidays. When Miri snapped on the overhead lights, Natalie covered her eyes.
"Don't!"
But Miri left the lights on and pulled the plug on the jukebox. Now it was completely quiet, eerily quiet. Come on, Nat, Miri said, grabbing her by both arms. Natalie resisted.
I'm too tired. We're all tired.
Miri hadn't realized how true that was until that minute. She felt heavy, as if she could sleep for a week. Finally, Natalie stood. Miri practically pushed her up the stairs. In the kitchen, Natalie spied her quilt and pillow on the floor. She grabbed them and ran up to her bedroom, where she threw herself onto her bed and held the pillow over her head. Miri followed.
They're out to get us, Natalie said from under the pillow. It's only a matter of time. Ruby says there's nothing we can do to stop them.
What are you talking about? Who's out to get us?
I'm trying to tell you, but you're not listening.
Miri lifted the pillow off Natalie's head so she could see her face, hear her words more clearly.
I am listening, but you're not making any sense. You think any of this makes sense? Mrs. Barnes's son and Phil's cousin, the one coming home from Syracuse. She was here New Year's Eve, remember? Kathy Stein. She wore a green velvet dress. My brother kissed her.
What about her?
She was on that plane.
How do you know?
Ruby told me.
No, she didn't.
You'll see.
Miri thought about shaking Natalie, shaking and shaking until Ruby came tumbling out head first, her dark hair spilling toward the floor, her blue eyes outlined in black, her lips painted bright red to match her short red dress, and at last, her shiny black tap shoes. But despite all the color, Ruby would still look dead, because that's what she was, dead. She wanted to shake Natalie until she was the old Nat, the one Miri became best friends with in seventh grade. When Miri didn't respond, Natalie asked,
"You think I'm crazy?
Are you?"
"Maybe," Natalie said. "I just want to stop seeing Phil's cousin dead and Mrs. Barnes's son in his captain's uniform, all broken and burned."
"Stop it," Miri said softly. "Just stop it."
"You'll see," Natalie said.
Then she closed her eyes and hid under the quilt. In the kitchen, Daisy forked whatever was browning in the pan, put it on a plate, covered it with wax paper, and slid it into the fridge. She tapped Ajax into the pan and started scrubbing, as Fern sang,
"Use Ajax, boom, boom, the foaming cleanser, boom, 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 boom."
Miri said, "I have to go home. My grandmother will be worrying."
She grabbed her coat and her books. "Thank you for helping," Daisy said. As she was leaving, Steve opened the kitchen door and pushed past her.
"Where's Mom?"
he asked Daisy.
"She's on her way home," Daisy told him.
"She was playing Mahjong at Seal Rubin's house," Fern said. "They didn't have the radio on, so they didn't know what happened."
Fern looked at Daisy.
"Right?"
Daisy nodded.
"What about Dad?" Steve asked.
"He took Mrs. Barnes home," Daisy said.
"Her son was the pilot of the plane that crashed," Fern added, hugging Roy Rabbit to her chest.
"Shut up about planes crashing," Steve shouted. "Just shut up."
Daisy touched Steve's shoulder. He flinched.
"Don't."
Miri asked, "Was Phil's cousin on that plane?" Steve shot her a look.
"How did you know?"
"Natalie told me."
"How did she know?"
Miri shrugged, pushed past Steve out the kitchen door, and trudged up the hill to the bus stop. When the bus pulled up, Miri boarded and took a seat, forgetting to pay. The driver didn't say anything. Miri was thinking that just a little while ago, she and Natalie were munching grapes in the den, waiting for Kate Smith to come on, singing "God Bless America." Miri hoped if there was a God, and she was less sure about that every day, he would bless America, and especially Elizabeth, New Jersey, and that he had the power to stop this thing that was happening. Suzanne, in her yellow rain slicker and white rubber boots, was waiting on the front steps of Miri's house, a polka-dot umbrella opened over her head, though it was hardly raining by the time Miri got home.
"Where were you?" Suzanne asked. "At Natalie's. Did you hear?"
"Yes, it's horrible."
"I know, but at least they say Betsy is still alive, and so is Mrs. Foster. They're both at St. Elizabeth's. My mother's on duty this afternoon."
"What are you talking about?"
"The crash. It hit the apartment building next to the Fosters and set their house on fire. Penny, she didn't get out. Mrs. Foster tried, but the fire..."
Miri slumped to the porch steps, her hand over her mouth. She tasted bile coming up.
"Mother of God, you didn't know?"
Miri shook her head. It wasn't possible. It had to be a mistake. But even as she thought it, wished it, she knew it was true.
"Bad things happen in threes," Irene said that night, doling out homemade vegetable soup and passing around warm bread. Not that anyone was hungry, but Irene knew how to tempt them.
"Stop it, Mama," Rusty said. "You're scaring Miri."
"Darling," Irene said to Miri, "am I scaring you?"
"No,"
Miri said defiantly. But she'd never get Irene's superstitions out of her head. Later, Suzanne came by again to go with Miri to the site of the crash, even though Rusty objected.
"There's no reason in hell for you to go there. You've seen one plane crash. Why do you have to see another?"
"Because the Fosters lived in that house," Miri argued. "Because a week ago we were babysitting Betsy and Penny, and now Penny is dead and Betsy is burned."
Her voice caught, thinking of how Penny always folded her little eyeglasses and placed them on her bedside table before she went to sleep. And Betsy's tiny pink toenails, newly polished, making her toes look like little shrimp. Maybe Mrs. Foster knew to worry. Maybe she'd had a sixth sense about an impending disaster. She'd heard mothers know these things instinctively.
"There's nothing to see," Rusty told them. "Just rubble and burned buildings."
"We have to go," Suzanne said.
Rusty pursed her lips, closed her eyes, took a deep breath, and reconsidered.
"Just don't be too long. I want a promise on that."
"Okay,"
Miri said.
"Be back before 8 o'clock.
Suzanne said,
"I promised my mother the same."
Rusty nodded.
"And take an umbrella."
A chill wind swept the open corner of South and Williamson streets. At the site, floodlights, combined with the fog and the light rain, sent up an eerie glow. Miri and Suzanne stood close. There was nothing to say. Nothing that would make sense of this. On the ground floor of the Foster's house, there used to be a candy store, popular with the St. Mary's kids. Now there was a burned-out shell with no roof and piles of rubble. There was no sign that it was hit by a plane. It could have been any kind of explosion, except for the piece of the tail. Not that Miri could see it, but everyone said it was there. Somewhere.
"They say she had to choose between her children," a woman said to her companion. "She couldn't save them both. Can you imagine?"
Was she talking about Mrs. Foster or someone else? Miri didn't want to think of Mrs. Foster trying to decide, "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo." Suddenly, Mason was behind her, his hands on her shoulders.
"Hey."
She whipped around. She'd thought he was at work.
"I have a friend who lived in that house," he said quietly. "The one that's gone now."
Miri and Suzanne both looked at him.
"Polina," he said. "She works at Janet. She has a little boy. Sometimes she kept Fred overnight."
"Are they okay?"
He shrugged.
They lost all their stuff. They have no place to live, but they weren't home when the plane crashed, so I guess you could say they're okay.
Miri didn't know how to reply, except to squeeze his hand to acknowledge his feelings. She wondered if Polina knew the Fosters.
If only Penny and Betsy hadn't been home, Suzanne said. If only Mrs. Foster had taken them someplace, to the library, maybe, or to a friend's house to play, a friend who lived in another neighborhood. If only...
If onlys don't work, Mason said. A policeman moved through the crowd. Go on now, he told them. Time to get home.
They took the bus back, got off at Suzanne's corner, then walked to Miri's, where she kissed Mason goodnight at the front door, hiding Fred inside her jacket. Upstairs, Henry was sitting at Rusty's kitchen table, mopping up what was left of Irene's vegetable soup with a thick slice of bread.
I shouldn't have let you go, Rusty said. I don't know what I was thinking.
It was an accident, Henry assured her. A tragic accident.
Twice in a row?
I know it doesn't make sense, Henry said, but I'm asking you to believe me.
He got up from the table and wrapped his arms around her.
Terrible things can happen, Miri. I'm so sorry about those little girls.
Miri dissolved when he said that, and when she did, Fred whimpered in sympathy. She unzipped her jacket. Fred cocked his head and looked around.
He can't stay at the Steins, she told Rusty. Phil's cousin was on that plane. And he can't stay with Mason's friend Polina, because she lived in the house the plane slammed into.
She didn't wait for Rusty to give her permission. She grabbed a copy of the Daily Post from the pile on the table, went to her room, and closed the door. It didn't take long for Rusty to knock. Miri. The door opened.
It's okay for Fred to stay tonight, just not in your bed.
But Miri had every intention of having Fred in her bed. Elizabeth Daily Post, Special Edition. Another plane falls. Raging Inferno destroys block of Williamson Street, by Henry Ammerman. January 22nd. It was a horrific scene of suffering and destruction, with bodies buried in the rubble that covered the wreckage of an American Airlines Convair en route to Newark Airport from upstate New York. The plane crashed today at 3:45 p.m. in heavy fog and driving rain, plowing into a block of houses on Williamson Street before exploding into an inferno. Residents of the houses fled, some with their clothes aflame. Every available police and fire resource in the city was summoned to the struggle, but it would be hours before the search for bodies could even begin. Ultimate horror only feet away. Students at Batten High School, across the street from the crash site, saw the plane skim the rooftop of their school just before the fatal crash. St. Mary's High School, catter-corner from Batten, escaped destruction, but an after-school crowd of its students were gathered at a confectionery on the ground floor of 310 Williamson Street. Knocked down by the initial explosion, they managed to escape before it burst into flames. Dead and missing. 6 residents, including 3 young children, are missing and feared dead, along with all 23 aboard the plane. Among the passengers on the plane were Robert Patterson, former Secretary of War under President Truman, and 4 students at Syracuse University. Less than 6 weeks ago and 1 mile away, a Miami Airlines C-46 crashed into a warehouse of the Elizabethtown Water Company, landing belly up in the frozen bed of the Elizabeth River. That crash killed all 56 on board, but spared those on the ground. Chapter 15. Distraction. This time, Miri read Henry's story all the way through. After that, she couldn't fall asleep, even with Fred gently snoring beside her. She thumbed through the paper until she came to the entertainment section, where the stories never made her sad. Gene Kelly had his appendix removed in Paris and was recuperating in Switzerland. Audrey Hepburn, 21 years old, opened in Gigi on Broadway, signed with Paramount Pictures, and was engaged to be married. There was a pin-up picture of Peggy Dow in a long gown. The caption read, "Now starring opposite Arthur Kennedy in Bright Victory, playing at the Branford Theater in Newark." The movie the Fosters went to see last Sunday night, or didn't see. Miri wondered now if they went to a motel, like Suzanne said. If they did, she hoped they had a good time, because she couldn't imagine them ever having a good time again. She realized she'd been wrong. Even stories in this section of the paper could make her sad. Rumors. At school, the rumors were flying. Pete Wolfe.
"What did I tell you? This proves it! Some alien thing is trying to take over Earth!"
Angelo Vanetti.
"UFOs. They've been sighted in New Mexico. The Martians want to turn us into zombies so they can control our planet."
Darish Gray.
"They want to take dead children to the past or the future to show what life was like in the mid-20th century on a planet called Earth."
Miri tried not to listen, tried to believe what Henry had told her, that both crashes were accidents. But she wasn't convinced. That wouldn't explain why three schools were almost hit, first Hamilton and now Batten and St. Mary's. And she remembered Leah telling them how close the first plane had come to the Elks Club on the day 100 little kids were at a holiday party. But why would Martians come to Elizabeth, New Jersey? What was so special about them that made these creatures from outer space come here? Or was it a mistake? Did they mean to land in New York? Were they after only dead children to carry back in their spaceships? Or did they want living children, too? Is that what they were going to do with Penny, who liked to dress up in her pink ballet slippers and leotard, showing Miri and Suzanne what she'd learned in dance class that week? Were they going to turn her into a zombie? She wasn't even sure what a zombie was. Something undead. Something that feasted on human brains. They'd probably all be dead by June, Miri thought. Forget prom and graduation. She just hoped it would be a quick death so they wouldn't suffer, so they wouldn't wind up horribly burned or blinded or left without arms and legs. It was coming. She didn't know what it was, but it was just a matter of time. She was beginning to believe they were jinxed. Donnie Kellen.
"McCarthy's doing the right thing, going after all the pinko Jew bastards like the Rosenbergs. They're the ones behind it. They should all be fried."
Suzanne.
"Leave the Jews out of this. This has nothing to do with Jews. Plenty of Jews were killed on those planes."
Donnie.
"You're such a Jew lover. That was just a cover to make it look like they're not responsible."
Charlie Kaminsky. To Donnie.
"You're an asshole, you know that? Stick your finger up your butt and take a whiff. That's you, a piece of shit."
Donnie came after Charlie, but Charlie socked him first, giving him a bloody nose. The other boys held Donnie and Charlie apart. Eleanor, shouting,
"It's sabotage, you idiots! We're under siege! Get it through your heads! Korea is nothing compared to what's happening here! Korea is a distraction. You don't hear Eisenhower saying, 'Nominate me for president and I'll stop these crashes tomorrow.' No, because he can't. Sure, he can stop the war in Korea, but he can't stop this one because our side doesn't know who we're fighting."
Everyone knew Eleanor was the smartest person in their class. So when she said sabotage, the rest of them went scrambling for the Merriam-Webster dictionary. Natalie watched, but said nothing, while the other kids went on and on, their stories of aliens, zombies, and sabotage growing from possibility to probability. She shook her head once or twice, as if to tell them they had it all wrong. but no one was watching besides Miri. What did Natalie know, or think she knew? They had another safety drill before lunch, proving Mr. Royer, the principal, also believed they were jinxed. A condolence call to Mrs. Barnes. On their way to pay a condolence call to Mrs. Barnes, Rusty insisted that Miri practice saying, "I'm sorry for your loss." Mrs. Barnes lived in an apartment house on Elmora Avenue, near Meiji. "I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry for your loss," Miri repeated. They'd left their house as soon as Rusty had come home from work, run a comb through her hair, freshened her lipstick, and spritzed herself with arpège. "If she offers her hand," Rusty said, "you shake it."
"I'm sorry for your loss. Shake, shake."
"This is not the time for sarcasm, Miri."
"When is the time for sarcasm, Mom?"
Miri would have liked to say, but she knew better. Instead, she said,
"I'm not being sarcastic. It's just, you're treating me like a 6-year-old.
"You've never been in this situation, and I'm trying to help you through it."
"Nobody's ever been in this situation."
"Not true, Miri. We've been through a war, remember? And we're fighting another one now. Some mother loses a son every day."
"Can you fight 2 wars at the same time?"
"You mean Korea and something else?" Rusty asked.
"Yes, Korea and something else."
"I hope that's never going to happen. Things are bad enough with Korea."
"So that means it's a good time to attack us because we're busy fighting in Korea. Korea is a distraction, right?"
"I'm not sure what you're getting at," Rusty said.
"Never mind," Miri told her.
She heard Eleanor's voice in her head. "Korea is a distraction." Corinne was at Mrs. Barnes's apartment, but there was no sign of the rest of the family, which surprised Miri. The small living room was crowded with family and friends who had come to pay their respects to Mrs. Barnes. Mrs. Jones was in the tiny kitchen with her daughter, Jameson, serving up plates of sandwiches and cookies.
"I'm sorry for your loss," Miri practiced inside her head.
But it turned out she didn't get to say it to Mrs. Barnes because Mrs. Barnes was in her bedroom and didn't come out. The other son was there, so Miri said it to him, and a daughter from Pennsylvania with her husband and little girl.
"I'm sorry for your loss."
She felt like an idiot saying it. Each of them took her hand and said, "Thank you." It wasn't as hard as she'd thought, but it felt wrong. She wished she could have told the truth.
"I was there when your mother heard the news over the radio. I was there when she screamed Tim's name and fell to her knees. I was there when Fern grabbed her leg and tried to go home with her, crying, 'Barnsey.' That's what Fern calls her. Did you ever dream someone would call your mother Barnsey?"
Rusty disappeared, leaving Miri alone in a room full of strangers. What was she supposed to do? She stopped in front of the family photos set out on the break front. Photos of Tim as a child, photos of him in his uniform, photos with his wife and 2 little girls. Captain Timothy Barnes was handsome, better looking than his brother or sister. Mrs. Barnes's daughter came up beside her.
"Did you know my brother?"
"I know your mother," Miri said. "Is she okay?"
"Not really. I doubt she'll ever be okay again. Tim was her favorite."
Miri never thought about parents having favorites. When you're the only child, you don't think that way. Corinne came to her rescue.
"I heard you were a big help on Tuesday, Miri. You've got a real head on your shoulders."
Miri knew that was supposed to be a compliment, as opposed to, "You have no head on your shoulders," or "Use your head for once."
"This has been very hard on Natalie," Corinne said, speaking in a hushed tone. "She's so sensitive, so imaginative. I suppose you know that."
"Yes."
She didn't have the guts to tell Corinne that Natalie was acting cuckoo. Anyway, who was she to say Ruby wasn't living inside Natalie? Who was she to say that wasn't the aliens' plan all along? All of it was making her think the whole world was going crazy. Jameson set a plate of sandwiches on the dining table, pretty little sandwiches on white bread with the crusts cut off, each decorated with a tiny pickle or slice of olive or sprig of parsley. Miri helped herself to a turkey sandwich. The potato salad had too much mayonnaise for her, so she skipped that and took potato chips instead. Corinne patted the sofa next to her, so Miri sat and bit into her turkey sandwich, taking small bites and chewing, chewing, chewing until there was almost nothing left to swallow, which she wasn't sure she'd be able to do anyway. She needed ginger ale. Why hadn't she poured herself a glass?
"I thought Natalie would be here," she managed to say.
"The children are at home. They went to the funeral this afternoon. Mrs. Barnes has been such an important part of their lives. She came to work for us when Fern was born, and Dr. Osner is back at the morgue." Miri nodded.
"Where's your mother?"
Corinne asked. "She must be in the other room," Miri said, taking this as her opportunity to get away.
"Actually, I think I'll bring her a sandwich."
She prepared a plate for Rusty and carried it down the hall. It was a small apartment, with two bedrooms and one bath. The door to the smaller bedroom was open. Miri caught a glimpse of Rusty's brown skirt. She was sitting on the bed with a group of women.
"Mom,"
Rusty looked up,
"I made you a plate."
"Thanks, honey. Come and sit." Miri sat next to Rusty on the small bed, wishing she could lie down with her head on Rusty's lap, close her eyes, and sleep. Visitation. It took days to find the remains of the sewing machine man and his wife, Mr. and Mrs. Galanos, who'd lived in one of the houses that had been destroyed. They'd been listed as missing and presumed dead. When they finally were able to identify them, Christina didn't want to go to the church or the funeral home. She didn't want to see the son, who was staying with friends. But she had no choice.
"We're going," her mother said. "Fix yourself up."
They waited online to express their condolences. First Christina's grandparents, Yaya and Papu, then her parents, then Athena, and finally Christina.
"I'm very sorry,"
she said to the son, who looked like he hadn't slept in days.
"Do I know you?"
he asked Christina.
"Christina Demetrius," she said. "My family knows..."
She hesitated, then changed what she was going to say to,
"My family knew your parents."
"Thank you, Christina."
That was it? She was free to move on now? Instead, she said,
"My sister Athena, you went to school with her."
"Thank you, Athena,"
he said, confusing her sister's name with hers. He didn't know what he was saying, or what anyone was saying to him. By then, the next person online was grabbing his hand and blubbering about what good people his parents were.
"He's in shock," Christina thought. "Everyone is in shock." Maybe she was, too. She thought about telling him she'd been there, about how she'd seen the plane before it crashed, and then the flames. But why would he want to hear that?
Athena reached in and pulled her away.
"What were you telling him?"
"Nothing."
"It looked like more than nothing."
"Why do you care?"
"Just don't go saying too much."
"What would be too much?"
Athena didn't answer her question. Instead, she said,
"You didn't even want to come, remember?"
"I thought I was supposed to be nice."
"Okay, so you were nice."
"I don't think anyone told him about me," Christina said, "that I'm the girl he's supposed to marry."
"Oh, so now you want to marry him?"
"I didn't say that. I just have the feeling no one mentioned Mama's plans to marry me off to him."
"I never knew you were in such a hurry to get married."
"I'm not."
She felt like shouting at Athena, who was turning everything around. Where was Dopey when she needed him?
She'd like to smash Dopey over her sister's head.
I have to sit down,
Athena said.
She was pregnant again and starting to show.
I thought you were in love with Jack McKittrick, Athena said, tugging at her skirt. So it's good to know you're keeping